Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is Mashable Senior Technical Correspondent, Christina Warren. Christina, thanks for being on the show.
Happy to be here.
It's nice to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us. As you know, Background Mode is quasi-biographical, and you're one of the most interesting and technical writers on the internet. I follow you closely, and I love everything you've written. And but before we get into that, I wanted to ask you about how you got where you are. It's always interesting to the listeners to kind of hear your background. How did you get started in this business?
Gosh, well, I've been writing professionally now for going on 9 years, and it started out, I've written for as long as I can remember, and I've written about all types of things, about entertainment and about tech, and those have been the two primary things I write about. But I started writing professionally for USA Today. This was in 2007 during American Idol. I was a frequent commenter on the then music editor of USA Today's blog about American Idol, and it was one of my guilty pleasure shows, and he liked my commentary on his blog so much he asked me to be a contributor to the print section and a blog that they were running about the show. And from there, I started blogging about other technology topics, other entertainment topics, and I joined Mashable in 2009 when the site was still very small. And I've over my almost 7 years at Mashable, gone from being staff writer to being, writer in different sections. I was the original entertainment editor, and now I'm the senior tech correspondent.
Entertainment editor. That may have something to do with your Twitter name, Filmgirl.
Yes. Film girl. So this is funny. Even though I am a technology journalist, my Twitter handle and my Instagram handle and my Snapchat handle is all film_girl. And that's because my background, what I actually have a degree in, is in film and video production. And that's one of my first loves is film. And I love film and I love television and I love media in general. And so when I joined Twitter in 2007, I didn't realize that my Twitter name would become a huge part of my online identity, but it did. And so at this point, it's one of those things where I can either keep what everybody knows me as, or I could switch it to something. The only thing I think I could switch it to would be @Christina. If I could somehow get the handle @Christina, I would definitely take that. But otherwise, I'm just going to keep film_girl. That was an online name I'd had before I joined Twitter, and it was just, the natural thing for me to use when I signed up for the service. So it's sort of funny that I write about tech, but my handle is Film Girl, and many times you will see things that I tweet about or do on other channels related to that side of my brain rather than tech.
Do you do any current entertainment blogging?
Not really. I mean, I don't have a lot of time for that, but I've always think about kind of doing side projects and doing things like that because I still am very much interested in media and in entertainment and in film and I always offer recommendations for people. There will be occasional moments where this isn't blogging per se, but as we record this a few days ago on Saturday morning, I happened to notice that the movie Bring It On was on Netflix. And so I live tweeted Bring It On for 90 minutes, and amazingly, people enjoyed it.
I've seen your tweets. Yeah. I watch you during... You watching something else.
Yes. Yeah. I always live tweet award ceremonies and things like that. And people, I tried to use hashtags so that people can mute me. I'll be like, thank goodness for 24-hour mute, or I'm muting your hashtag, Christina. I don't want to see this. And that's totally fair. But I think at this point, people know that if you follow me on Twitter, you're probably going to get a heavy dose of tech-related things and entertainment-related things in your stream, because those are the things I like, and that's what Twitter's good for.
You have a very interesting background. You're similar to Serenity Caldwell, who's been on the show.
I love Serenity. She's a great person, and she's a great journalist too. And yeah, we're right. We do. We have a lot in common, and that's we've talked about that before because our backgrounds. We didn't come into journalism, particularly tech journalism, in the traditional way. I was fortunate that I started writing was kind of the golden age for internet writing, and when you could actually kind of make the transition into a full time career that way. And now, most people who get jobs places where I work, went to journalism school, and I went to college, but I don't have a journalism background per se. I certainly am a journalist and I've learned all those things, but it was one of those things where I didn't come at it from studied journalism. I studied film and video production and I took journalism classes. But if you'd asked me, 15 years ago when I was graduating from high school, if this is what I thought I'd be doing, I probably wouldn't have said yes, but at the same time, I would not have been surprised that this is what I'm doing.
Can I ask you, and may I ask you what you were doing in high school? In the sense that many of the technical people who I've encountered had those early seeds and, you know, took high school physics and math and stuff like
yeah.
that.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I've always been very technical. And so I studied, you know, computer science, and I took computer programming classes, and I built my own web pages. And funnily enough, me and a friend of mine had founded a review site called reviewcenter.com. It was a great domain back in the day. This was like 1999, 2000. And we would review, you know, products and software. And so funnily enough, I was doing a lot of the same things I do now on a web page then. And I was learning programming and I was really interested in tech. But I wasn't like my primary focus. I was making movies and writing like screenplays, and that's what I thought I was going to do with my life, was that. But at the same time, I'd always had this passion for technology, and especially writing about tech and reading. Then it wasn't really blogs, although blogs were starting to come out, but, you know, reading websites and magazines about all that stuff. So it's funny that I do what I do now, because in some ways, like I said, I would have been surprised, but in other ways I would have said, no, this is totally exactly what I would be doing.
You are sort of an Apple focused person.
Yeah, I am. I wouldn't say I'm specifically focused on Apple, because I write about a lot of different platforms, but mm-hmm. Apple, especially early on in my tech career, was one of the companies I focused on a lot. One of my first blogging jobs was for the unofficial Apple weblog, and I wrote there.
Oh, yeah. You must know Steve Sandy, then.
Of course I know Steve and Michael Rose and Dave Kahlo and Victor Agreda.
Victor, yeah.
Great guys. And I worked there, you know, for, I guess it was almost 2 years. That was one of my first blogging jobs. And I always credit Michael Rose as being my mentor, both for online writing and for podcasting. And so Apple's always been a company that, even going back to when I was in middle school, I was really interested in. And that was right when the Steve Jobs was coming back, and it was kind of going through that transition. And my first introduction to a lot of computing and to repairing computers and to, you know, knowing how networking works and things like that were in my school's Mac lab. And so a lot of my early technical experience, and even things like editing video, was on a Mac at school. And so I've always loved Apple. And I've always just found them to be an interesting company, even though I was a Windows user until I was in college.
Oh, no.
I used Macs at school, but I used Windows at home, which, you know, in the late 90s was a very common occurrence, right? Because, you know, that the state of the Mac back then was obviously not great. Things were going into transition. But I remember always being super interested by everything. I would read Glenn Fleischman's newsletter that he had, and Dave Weiner's too. And you know, I always kept abreast of that stuff, even way back then. You know, I was, you know, 13, but I cared a lot about it. And so it was kind of a natural thing for me when I started trying to find writing gigs, when I started realizing I wanted to try my hand at this writing thing, it made sense for me to say, well, let me reach out to some of these Apple sites and see if I can write for one of them. And TUAW was looking for writers, and I applied. And when I...
Or as Steve says, Tua!
Tua, exactly, Tua. And when Tua, it was funny, I applied and I didn't hear anything for about a month. And I figured, I was like, well, that's maybe my sample articles weren't that good. But at the same time, I knew they were. And so I was like, well, this is weird, but okay, whatever. And then when they came back, when Victor came back, he said, well, we want you to write for Tua. We also have this site called Download Squad, which was kind of like Engadget for software. And we would like you to write for both. And I was like, okay, great. So I wrote for both sites.
If I had to guess, I would guess that right now in this podcast, you are talking to me. I can see your Blue Yeti. I would guess that you're on a MacBook Pro.
I am.
Just my guess. Bingo.
Bingo. What size?
Because you're mobile, Christina, I would guess it's a 13 instead of a 15 for airline travel.
It's actually 15, but this almost exclusively stays on my desk. When I have to travel more, I have the 13-inch MacBook Air. So close. You're close. But yeah, no, I'm on a MacBook Pro, and 15 inches is my main machine. But when I have to travel, I have a work MacBook Air.
How do you compose your articles? I'm curious about what tools you use to construct your articles and get them published.
Sure. So I write everything in TextMate, the text editor TextMate, and that is not how most people compose things, but I've been doing that literally since 2007. So I write everything in Markdown, and I actually have tools that will help me auto-link things that go with our CMS. And then I used a program called Marked that my friend Brett Terpstra makes to convert the the markdown text into rich text. And that's because our CMS at Mashable, we have a new kind of custom CMS. It does not accept me to just paste in HTML like our old one did. So, but it will accept me to let me paste things in from rich text. So I write everything in TextMate using markdown, and then I convert that to rich text, and then I paste that into our CMS.
Interesting, interesting. I write everything in BBEdit, do a little bit of hand HTML, and then drop it into our system where the rest of it's taken care of.
Yeah. So you have a similar system with me, and I like it that way. I enjoy writing in Markdown because it's readable, and when you're writing for the web and there's so many links and there are other things, I just find it easier for the way my brain works. And I've been doing it, you know, like I said, for 9 years at this point now that way. But it's always funny when people see that I'm writing in basically a code editor. I'm sure you have people remark the same way with you when they see it in a BBEdit. You know, they seem a little surprised, but for me, that's how my brain works. And I write things, not always, but I typically, especially if it's a long article, you know, I start with an outline process first, and then I go through and I fill out, you know, where I want to fill it out. But I usually outline kind of the article first, and then I fill it in, I fill in the blanks.
Do you use any special tools, like one of the Omni tools for outline?
Not really. It depends. I mean, if it's a really big project, I might. But in general, I just kind of lay out my outline in TextMate, you know, using H2 tags and putting maybe points under each section that I know I want to get to and then filling them in. If I were writing a book or like a more in-depth tutorial, I might use an outline tool, or I might even use something like Scrivener. But typically,
Scrivener, yes.
Yeah.
It's an excellent tool.
It's an excellent tool. But typically, I just use Markdown.
Cool. So let me ask you about your move coming along and the nurturing part of your work. You mentioned that Mr. Rose at Tua was one of your mentors.
Yeah.
Do you feel like it's been important in your career to have people who are supporting you and mentoring you and bringing you along because of your talent and your abilities? Is that continuing on at Mashable?
Oh yeah, most definitely. It's so important when you meet people, whether they work with you or even sometimes I've even had people at competitors who have been very helpful in introducing me to people, you know, to get to know people. Introductions go a long way, especially with companies and especially with people that might be good in the industry. And so I always think back about people who've helped me along the way, and I try to pay it forward any way I can, you know, whether it's writing an email of introduction or giving somebody advice about how to do something or just offering feedback on an article. Because to me, when I look back on my career, I look at people that I've worked with, you know, some have moved on to other places, some I still work with, you know, who've gone out of their way to help or to give me good feedback. And that always is really useful. I think especially as a writer, you know, as journalists, having a good editor can be really important because I can look at a story that I've written that is good, but if I've had a good editor on it and they've made changes that have made it better, then that makes me get better. Because that I always look at those changes and think, oh, I really like what they did here, or cutting this section was good, this was a solid move. And so I've been very privileged to work with some very good editors and work with some very good other reporters and journalists over the years who've been very helpful to me. And even people who haven't worked with me directly, just knowing people in the industry, especially when I started writing about technology, I actually lived in Atlanta, and now I live in New York. And in New York, there's a tech scene, and I certainly have access to companies, especially working at Mashable. But early on, you know, there were people who I didn't have access to. And so when I would go to a certain events and I would meet people in person for the first time, there were sometimes, you know, some amazing people who would go out of their way to introduce me to others. And I always think about that in my own life and say, you know, anytime I can do that for someone else, I want to do that because I think it's important.
Cool. Well, that's an awesome introduction to your background, and it's nice to get to know you better, because we often see writers as people who just suddenly arrived on the scene, and it's always helpful to see how people evolved and where they've been and the people who've helped them and mentored them and how they've technically evolved and so on. I think this is a really good place to take a break. Folks, we have to take a short commercial break here. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Christina, when we come back, I want to ask you about everything Apple.
All right.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we're back with Christina Warren. So you wrote on April 16th, one of the most awesome technical security articles I've ever written, I've ever seen in my whole life. It was an assessment of Apple's presentation on the security elements of iPhones. It was Apple opens up on how it approaches security following the FBI battle. And this was drawn from comments that Apple made at a briefing. It was drawn from the iOS security manual. It had amazing integration of both the technical part and the philosophy. Tell us how that article came to be.
Well, Apple, you know, during there was obviously a lot of discussion about security and iOS involved with the San Bernardino case involving the FBI and Apple involving, you know, a locked iPhone used by one of the shooters in the San Bernardino incident. And I covered that case significantly for Mashable. And Apple reached out and they said, we're going to be having a security roundtable with a number of members of the press and some analysts. And they invited me to come. And so I flew out to Cupertino and it was me and about 10 or 11 other journalists and analysts in a room with Apple executives who gave a big presentation about basically a big overview of how iOS security works. And so I basically, you know, it was about a three and a half hour briefing, and I basically synthesized that briefing as best I could, along with elements from, as you said, you know, the iOS security white paper and other things I knew into the article that you mentioned.
During the briefing, did the Apple executives say to you and all the others, this is public, we want you to write about this, everything we say here is on the record?
Everything was on the record. The people who spoke was not on the record, so I couldn't actually quote verbatim the individuals that spoke. But what they said was on background and on the record, and certainly the contents of what they said was on the record. And I mean, I have to imagine that the reason that they held that briefing is because they wanted the press to get a better understanding of how iOS security works, and because it's an important concern. You know, so much was being written at that time, and still is, you know, about security and privacy and Apple's, you know, kind of overall approach to those two things. And having a technical understanding of what actually is happening, and also giving journalists and analysts an opportunity to ask questions, became really, I think, important. And so it was good to have that opportunity. And so, you know, my goal with writing that piece was just to try to explain things in a way that was both accurate, which was very important, but also readable for someone who might not have a huge grasp on security or you know, privacy stuff.
That was one of the most notable things about that article. It took a very complex subject, wove in the technology, Apple's viewpoint, and made it very readable and understandable. But it was a rather long article. It was rather
very
intimidating.
Long.
I think it was something like, 2,800 words or so?
Something like that. It was 2,200 or 2,300 words, I think. And that was actually after an edit. So that was actually an entire section on sandboxing was cut because, you know, so the briefing ended in the afternoon on Friday and then it published early Saturday morning. And so I basically had, you know, maybe, I don't know, 11 hours or so to kind of get the whole thing together. And I had, you know, it was a 3.5 hour presentation, and so my notes, I think, were 3,500 words. And so that was just my notes. And so I then distilled that down to, I think, like 2,700 or 2,800 words. And then I cut, you know, an entire section for readability. And that was something that
did you do that, or did your editors insist?
My editor, she came in. It was the person who was working that Saturday morning, and she's amazing. She's actually based out of our London office, and she actually said, you know, this is really good, but this is really long. Can we cut anything? And it was one of those situations where I couldn't cut anything in the sections themselves because of the way it was written and because of how technical it was. I couldn't just cut paragraphs or even make sentence stuff. If I was going to cut anything, I needed to cut a section. And so I looked at the different sections and I said, you know, even though the sandboxing stuff is really interesting, it's not as imperative to the entire story as everything else. So I cut that section. And I think that was the right choice because, as you said, it was a long article. I think it read very well, but it was a long article.
Well, we always worry in this business about losing the readers. Too long, didn't read it. And there is a place for an article like that. If somebody wants to sit down and have a cup of coffee and spend some time on a Saturday morning, there's an awful lot to learn about what Apple's doing in that article. Yeah. I'm so glad that you were allowed to publish it. Even with some mild cuts, it was still pretty long.
It was still very long.
It was amazing.
Thank you. And what really made me feel good, A, that the editor that I worked with, Liza, she was fantastic. She made some, you know, made sure that my grammar was on point and really kept the essence of everything there. But what the best compliment I think I kind of had, I knew that I'd achieved my goal when she said, I really enjoy this. I learned a lot, because she's not a tech editor. You know, she's a general editor. And so that made me think, okay, I've achieved my goal. My mom said the same thing. My mom said this. My mom, who is not technical, but reads everything I write, really enjoyed it. And so what's always challenging about an article like that is that you know that it's very important that it be technically accurate, because you don't want to be spreading the wrong information. But at the same time, it has to be accessible, because the whole point of them having that conversation with the press is that they want regular people to get the message. And so, you know, finding that balance, you know, it probably took me about 5 hours to write. And I just, it was one of those things where, you know, you just get in a zone and you just get through it. And then you look back and you make the edits you need to make. In that case, it was cutting the section. In a perfect world, I would have, you know, that section would have been kept in, you didn't, as you said, you don't want it to become so overwhelming, especially when it's a technical subject like that. And one gratifying thing, you know, the story did well for us, but it especially did well in terms of when we look at our statistics of average time spent on articles. It was, I think, one of the top stories for that week in terms of one of the ones that our visitors spent time on, which made me feel really good, because that said, not only are people reading this, but they're actually spending a long time reading it, which is great.
So having written an article like that, how did you feel before and now after about how well the technical journalists are communicating these key ideas in general, the rest of the people? Because there's an awful lot of pressure from law enforcement. You know, the Attorney General came on, Stephen Colbert presented her side. There are people who are talking about how we have to have warrants. We have to be able to get in. We have warrants for people's offices and papers. We have to have a warrant to get into the system. And there is this technical idea here that once we start messing with the security of these phones, that we've unleashed Pandora's box here. And how well is the technical community doing in communicating the real essentials?
I think they're doing a pretty good job. I mean, I think that most people, at least, even if whether you agree that, you know, law enforcement should have access or not, I think that the fundamental idea, which is you kind of can't separate the two, you either have encryption or you don't, is something a lot more people are starting to understand. And I think this is what was an important part of the entire conversation, which was, you know, if you just hear on the face of it, you know, a terrorist, you know, had, you know, this phone, the FBI needs to get into it, help us get into it. You think, well, if this could prevent terrorism, of course, get us into the phone. But when you start to think about the fact that, you know, these decisions for the security of these devices are not being made to keep law enforcement out. They're being made to keep criminals out. They're being made to keep your stuff safe. That becomes a much more complex thing to understand. And so I think that that's kind of, you know, we had Stephen Levy wrote a great article for Back Channel, his Medium publication, kind of about the history of some of this sort of stuff, going back to the clipper chip back in the 90s. And, you know, we've had this conversation before. We had it 20 years ago where we had somebody had this brilliant idea. Well, we can have encryption, but it'll only, you know, won't be accessible to anybody except law enforcement. And if that could actually work, then maybe that would be an interesting discussion to have, but that's not how it works. And so I think that it becomes very important for us to have the discussion. Now, if you want to make the decision that, you know, public safety in the realm of law enforcement having access is more important than user privacy, I think you can have that argument, and you might be able to make that case in some countries and some law enforcement agencies, and some individuals might feel that way. But I feel like we have to have an honest conversation that it really kind of is either or. Either we have encryption or we don't. And as clear as we can be about that, I think is important. And I think what's important, you know, Apple, what they were saying repeatedly and what I tried to get across in the article, and I'm certainly not acting as an apologist for them, but just, you know, passing on what they were saying, and I think this comes through, is that their decisions about how they have created security for iOS has not been in response to keeping law enforcement out. It's simply a matter of, you know, they have, you know, criminals, millions and millions of criminals, hackers trying to get into these devices, right? Because these devices are so central to our lives. And
if only we could look at the iPhone's logs and see how many attempts there are to break into the phones, we'd be scared to death.
We would. And when you think about everything you put on your phone, when you think about everything you trust on your phone, you know, it's the most personal item you have. Having that be secure is very, very important. And there, no matter what law enforcement might want, there's not a way for them to kind of separate those two things. Now, having said that, if law enforcement wants to develop their own techniques of bypassing that encryption and bypassing those things and hacking into things themselves for their own surveillance purposes, I mean, more power to them. If they can do it, they can do that. But I think that it's a very different proposition to say we will invest in trying to do that ourselves versus making companies let them have access. Because when you do that, you end up making everything unsafe. And at that point, you know, the reality is that more people would be hacked by criminals than, you know, crimes would be solved.
Well said. Well said. So let's switch gears here for a second.
Sure.
How does Film Girl feel about the current state of iTunes? How did it get where it is? And why is it one of the most annoying apps now when it used to be our iPod companion? Yes. That was glorious.
It was so great. It was this great app, and now it's become this albatross. And even on the Mac, it's terrible, right? Like, for a long time, you could say, well, it's terrible on Windows, but if you just get a Mac, iTunes is still great.
No, it isn't.
Now it's terrible, and they keep adding more to it. And I almost wonder, you know, they've got all these legacy devices that they still support, which is important. And they have, you know, for a long time, it was still kind of built, you know, in web objects, you know, was the back end for it. And I have to wonder if so much of this legacy code has just made the app just too big and bloated, you know, when it's trying to do too many things. It's your, you know, manager for files. It's your store. It's your playback mechanism. It's your backup and sync tool. And if it were me, you know, I mean, I think you need to just start separating that stuff out. I think Apple Music should be its own app. If you want to sync it with your core iTunes library, I think that's completely fine. But iTunes Music, or Apple Music rather, should be its own app. And I also feel like I think the syncing tool at this point should be its own app.
Do you think Apple will actually do that? I've seen a lot of people write about that. Our Kelly Guman has. Yeah. Our Mr. Keat has. I know that Kurt McElhern probably has written about that. I have. Sure, you have.
Yep.
But it doesn't look like Apple's interested in doing that. Do you think maybe they're never going to do that and let it just die? And
I think they have to eventually. I mean, I think they're going to have to find a way to kind of replace things. I think if you look at what they did with Photos, and I don't necessarily love everything in the new Photos app, but, you know, they kind of took iPhoto apart and rebuilt it. And if you look at, to a lesser degree, what they did with iMovie and some of those things, they're not afraid to rewrite those apps and to revisit those
experiences.
I wish they'd hurry up. I would hope that for Apple Music, they will just release a separate Apple Music app, even if it means still keeping iTunes around. You know, I feel like if they're trying to gain traction with their music service, it right now on the desktop, one of its core problems is that it's associated with iTunes, and it becomes kind of a mess when you want to try to find things. There are too many ways you can go to do things. So I think just make an Apple Music app. But I really do hope that they start to separate the two out. And if you have to keep iTunes around for legacy purposes, fine. But find other ways at least to let people do things, because it's annoying to have to use use, you know, apps like PhoneView or iExplorer or anything else to manage your iPhone, because that's an easier way of managing stuff than opening up the albatross that is iTunes, because iTunes is a mess.
It is. It is. Last week, there was a rumor that Apple might stop selling music because of the popularity of streaming.
Right.
Of course, Apple's Tom Neumeyer came out and said, nope. But, you know, Apple does tend to follow trends pretty strongly.
How do you feel about that? I mean, I think that it's way too soon to tell. I think that the whole, I feel like, are there some people inside Apple who are probably looking at projections and saying, look, in 5 years, our sales component of iTunes will be very small and streaming will make up the most of our business and we might be able to phase things out? Sure. I think that's possible. But at the same time, I can't imagine them setting a cutoff date for music, because until it gets to the point where it costs more to maintain than it does what you're selling things off, I don't see them having a problem selling things alongside streaming. You know, a lot of other services do that. Google does that. Tidal does that. Amazon does that. And, you know, Spotify does not do that, but they might be better off if they did, because frankly, they might make more revenue that way. So I feel like, you know, our music reporter, Emily Blake, she spoke to some indie labels, and they would actually be very, very hurt if Apple were to get out of that, because even though streaming as a whole now makes more than digital sales, it's very minute. You know, iTunes is still the leading digital player. You know, a lot of indie labels make the bulk of their revenue because they sell through iTunes, and getting rid of that and having to rely strictly on a streaming model where they're paid royalties at much different rates would hurt a lot of artists. And so, eventually, do I think that'll probably happen? Sure. The same way, you know, Netflix is really focused now on streaming, and it, you have to really jump through a lot of hoops if you want to get DVDs in the mail. But Netflix still does offer DVDs through the mail. And so I feel like I don't see Apple getting rid of that feature until it costs significantly more to maintain than it does to just sell the files. At the very least, because they've been doing it for so long, because they are the leading player. If it was a smaller company that didn't rely as much on digital music sales, you might be able to make that argument. But for Apple, you know, they've already got the infrastructure built in. Why not continue doing it?
Well, one of the considerations that we've talked about here at the Mac Observer is that an excessively large library of purchased music has to be managed, has to be backed up. There could come a day when Apple would perceive that all the music you've purchased is better off managed by them, by, say, a Siri agent in the cloud, available to you everywhere, and your backup troubles are over. So we've kind of tossed up that idea.
That would be great. Look, if they wanted to store it all in iCloud, that would be fantastic. If I could have a section in iCloud that called purchased music, that was all my purchased files, and I didn't actually have to go into iTunes and go into purchased and do a search and download things manually, I would love that. And if they even wanted to turn off the match aspect of iTunes Match and just make it a pure cloud storage locker and store it in my iCloud, I would be in favor of that too. So eventually, maybe that's what they do, right? If they want to get out of that business. But I think you bring up a key point, which is why I don't think they will be getting out of the music sales business for so long, is that they've literally been selling people digital music since 2003. And if you were to even slowly get out of that business, that means you still probably have to maintain copies of those files for at least some period of time for people to offload them, because you can't have people who have been used to being able to download their files for years and then suddenly say, well, we no longer sell them, and so you can't access what you purchased before. Because that's just, A, that's not the Apple way of doing things, but B, that would be just a terrible customer service move to say, you bought this album, but we will no longer let you access it.
Right. There's some sticky issues there. Well, we only have a few minutes left, and I wanted to spend the time we have remaining talking about Apple TV.
Sure.
I assume you have one.
Of course.
4G.
Absolutely.
Were you annoyed that it didn't have 4K when it came out last year?
No. Would it have been a good move? Maybe. But I feel like 4K is problematic in the sense that, A, there's not a ton of 4K content. Most of it that is coming in is still compressed. And the reality is that in the United States, which is obviously going to be Apple TV's biggest market for right now, bandwidth usually isn't good enough for people to support 4K. So I wasn't annoyed, but it would have been nice to see. But I don't even have a 4K TV, primarily because there's not enough content for it. You know, I feel like that'll be an easy upgrade that they can do in you know, 2 years or so when the sets are the default and when there's a lot more content available and hopefully internet is faster.
One of my theories is that they were waiting for the HDR situation to sort itself out, both streaming and other media, right?
I agree. I feel like jumping on it now would have been making a bet they didn't need to make. I mean, you know, you have devices like the NVIDIA Shield and things like that that can do it, and you obviously have some 4K TVs that can do it. But right now, I mean, just the dearth of content for 4K, I think, would make adding that feature in probably not worth the extra expense.
A couple of weeks ago, Comcast announced they were changing the caps in some key cities in a test program to 1 terabyte.
That's great.
And one of the feedbacks that they got commonly from customers was, you know, we'd love to go to 4K, but we're afraid of streaming 4K because it's going to blow our caps. So
it's going to blow your caps. Yeah.
That's just one piece of the pie there, what Comcast did. And we hope they roll that out nationwide eventually.
No, absolutely. I'm lucky that my cable provider and internet provider does not have caps at all. But that's a very real consideration. And the fact that it took, you know, I mean, in Comcast, who's trying to push 4K, the fact that they've had to do that because, as you said, their users are telling them, we are afraid to use it because we will blow through our data caps. And that right there says everything you need to know about, like, why, you know, even though 4K TVs are less and less expensive, the content situation hasn't caught up.
Very good. Very good. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up because we're out of time. Christina, tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish.
Sure. Well, you can follow me at Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram, at film_girl. And you can find my writing at mashable.com/people/Christina.
Cool. Christina, it was a pleasure to have you on the show. This was a delightful discussion. And I really enjoyed having you on the show. It was wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fantastic.
It was fantastic. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show, too. Thanks for coming by. We'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.